First fruits of harvest. Umoja. Uhuru. Unity and freedom. Ujima. Ujama kuhumba. Kujitagalia. Imani ania. From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Dialogue is an exchange about culture, straight from the soul. You can catch us on Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul. From Illinois to Louisiana and Indiana, from the West Indies to the continent of Africa, no matter where our people were born, traveled to, or have been taken, we brought our culture and our love of innovation and food with us. Our creativity has fed nations. On today's dialogue, we're taking a look into our rich traditions and the connected tapestry of the Black diaspora of food during the holidays. At any moment as you enter Neal Street Blues, you'll see a DJ playing the music that has defined generations and food that hums out of the kitchen. That has been the atmosphere they always wanted to create as they've been serving up iconic soul food. At the heart of this space, Gail Stark's vision was to fulfill a community need. Black residents wanted a space to commune, to gather, and enjoy food that stirs spirit. Gail Starks, the owner of Neal Street Blues, was determined to create a home for Black culinary excellence.
All right, so I have Miss Gail Starks with me here today, and we are in the kitchen of Neal Street Blues.
Yes, we are, the best place to be.
I love it. So, what are you doing right now? Tell us a little bit about this incredible sweet potato pie.
Well, actually, we're getting ready for Thanksgiving, and I only fix, I think I prepare sweet potato pies like twice a year now, and it's usually around Thanksgiving and Christmas. Occasionally, I will do pies for special occasions, but it takes a lot of mixing and a lot of love, and unfortunately, in the restaurant business, it's hard to cook enough sweet potato pie to feed the masses, so I only do it on special occasions.
And you just told me that you don't measure.
Well, not with the sweet potato pie. It's particularly because the potatoes can have a different flavor and different texture based on where they're grown, and it picks up the nutrients from the soil that they come in. But sometimes you need to add a little bit of this or a little bit of that, or an extra pinch of this or an extra pinch of that. So it's really hard to do a firm recipe with sweet potato pie.
How long has Neal Street Blues been in Champaign?
Well, we've been open since the fall of 2018, so about 6 years. Black Friday is actually our anniversary, so that's coming up the day after Thanksgiving. We survived a lot of ups and downs and challenges, but the food has kept us here.
How did Neal Street Blues start?
That's a very good question. We were actually sitting around the dinner table one holiday, and we were talking about the fact that when we go visit our other relatives in other cities, Jackson, Mississippi, Memphis, Tennessee, all of those places had good soul food restaurants that we could go to that also had a sense of entertainment. It also had an entertainment vibe to it. So it was good food, good music, lots of fun. And in Champaign, we just was missing that. So we saw a gap. And my grandmother was always encouraging us to be entrepreneurial. So we decided that we would try to fill that gap with Neal Street Blues.
Your grandmother, like you said, was kind of an inspiration within this. Did you feel that cooking was always in you or in your family?
It's always been in the family. She's always made sure we were good cooks. If we were going to cook anything, it had to be right. My grandmother, she was one of the first Black head cooks at the University of Illinois dormitory. She was the most magnificent person, but the most magnificent cook that I've ever known. And she could cook anything, Italian food, Spanish food, African food, and of course soul food. And it was really interesting because when I first started my first year at the university, I lived at the dorm that she worked in, Busey Evans. And every so often, they would have a special day where the cooks could cook whatever they want. Well, everybody around the campus would come to Busey Evans' dorm to cook, because when my grandmother could do her own thing, it was magnificent and everybody wanted to eat it. So I had a little bit of the special advantage. I could jump to the front of the line because I knew the head cook, but the lines were out the door. So she made sure we knew how to cook.
Mm-hmm. And we knew how to eat too.
Oh yes, that's for sure.
Right now, you're making sweet potato pies, and you're the only establishment in Champaign and Urbana that's selling these pies for special order. Is that right?
Well, I can't say only. I'm sure there's probably some catering person somewhere, but I'm not aware of anyone else that that's doing it at the moment. Mm-hmm. We've just kind of made it a special tradition, but after 6 years, I no longer publicize it because it's too much. If I were to publicize it, I'd have to have probably a big vat with, you know, maybe 100 dozen eggs and all that good stuff. So the people who've supported us over the years, they know that they can call me and I'll have their sweet potato pie ready. And hopefully we're going to ramp up over the next 6 years. We'll increase our capacity and then I'll be selling them to the public.
Yes. What does it mean for you, I mean specifically with the pies, to just be making this special for the people who do know, who have been supporting you? What does it mean for you and also the community just to receive this?
Well, it doesn't stop with the pie. Everything that I cook, I really cook with the intention of it being good and from the heart. The sweet potato pies have just had a historical meaning for people in our family, our culture. Again, it's one of those things. I was blessed. My grandmother would cook them all the time. But for most people, you just got them at the holiday. So whenever I think about the holiday and I want to do something special for people I care about, guess what comes up? Sweet potato pie. And Jordan, he's probably one of our oldest cooks here. Been here almost since the beginning. He's my taster. He'll let me know if something's off or not.
I want that job.
Yeah, that's a good one. We always tell people when they first start working here, you've heard of the freshman 15? Mm-hmm. Well, we've got the Neil Street Blues 15. Ooh. You're going to pick up 15 pounds because you got to taste the food.
Can you talk a little bit about the legacy and just continuing to carry on this tradition within your family and also for Black cuisine?
Well, you know, that's really important because I think as we've gotten to this internet culture, you know, we've all become closer yet farther apart. A lot of cultures kind of, you know, share their things over the internet. But I think it's really important that we have that interpersonal family, oral traditions, pass down things. It just really kind of grounds you. And both of my children work here. I'm really blessed. My daughter, Brittany. She's phenomenal in the kitchen. She's the quiet one. She likes to help me out whenever she can with whatever we need. She's like hones in and makes a recipe perfect. Michael, now he's the voice of the operation. He's a talker. He likes to talk. He does a lot with the bar drinks, and making sure that our entertainment, he does a lot with that as well. But just having nieces, nephews, cousins, all of those folks have worked here in some capacity at some time, and it's just really heartwarming to be able to share the recipes that we've had over the years. Mm-hmm. Thanksgiving, we now celebrate it here at the restaurant. It's just easier. You got a commercial kitchen, and you got to cook all that food. It just makes it easier. But so Neil Street has become part of our home, part of our family. Mm-hmm. And that's what it's all about.
I love it. What do the holidays mean for you at the restaurant and for the family business?
It's not quite the same. I lost my mother and my father through the whole COVID episode. I also lost a very dear nephew. So I think it's still fresh for us. And so when you get to the holidays, you have sort of a happiness because of the holiday and holiday spirit, but you're sad because it reminds you of those that you are not able to celebrate with today. And in the restaurant business, one of the things that we've learned is that there's very few days off. So while the rest of the world might be off on the holiday, many times we're here working. So it's usually the day after the holiday that becomes a little bit more special for us. But either way, it's become part of our family tradition to get together. We cook for the community, and then we cook for ourselves. We're so glad to be here. We're so glad that people enjoy the food. We're so glad that we've built memories now for other people. They come here now with their families, and they've said, hey, this is our fourth Thanksgiving with you guys. And that makes us part of their memories, so it's really special.
Gail Starks, thank you so much for letting me back into the kitchen with you guys today.
Thank you so much for being here. Now you can grab your apron and we can put you on the line, get you cooking.
Here we go. And then I can be the taster.
The taster. Now you gotta be promoted for that job.
That was Gail Starks, the owner of Neal Street Blues. Their experience is open to all, as they're on the corner of West Hill and North Neal Street in Champaign. Up next, how have African-American culinary traditions shaped American life within the last 400 years? We'll be hearing from food anthropologist Deb Freeman.
Interesting thing that she did, she put white potatoes in her collard greens.
Stay with us on Dialogue after this short break. From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Dialogue is an exchange about culture, straight from the soul. You can catch us on Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul. On today's dialogue, we're taking a look into our rich traditions and the connected tapestry of the Black diaspora of food during the holidays. Deb Freeman joins me today. She's a food anthropologist, cultural storyteller, and guardian of Black culinary history. Deb Freeman's work transcends the traditional boundaries of food scholarship, revealing how Black foodways carry the DNA of resistance, joy, and survival. Through her groundbreaking podcast, Setting the Table, and her fearless exploration of food's role in Black liberation movements, she illuminates the profound connections between what we eat and who we are. Freeman is the food editor for Style Weekly, and she's the producer of the upcoming docuseries Finding Edna Lewis, delving into the life of one of America's most influential and overlooked culinary legends. And we are honored to have Deb Freeman join us today on Dialogue.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Your work reveals how Black food traditions are archives of resilience and joy. The holidays are really a time when food and memory become inseparable. You just remember everything that's been passed down within your family. How do the dishes we pass down during Kwanzaa or Christmas embody African Americans' storytelling throughout our history?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's such a great question to open up with, because one of the things that, you know, I like to kind of set the table with, no pun intended, is to think about all the things when West Africans were brought to this country, all the things that were taken away from us, our name, our language, all of those sorts of things. But what we retained, one of the most important things we retained, really was our food. And so, and how we prepare certain things, how we season certain things, the ingredients may be different, but that essential, you know, ethos of the way that West Africans prepare food, you see in southern United States, and then obviously after Great Migration throughout the rest of the country. And so that legacy of passing things, foods down, passing recipes down from generation to generation, that really still exists because of our heritage, because we were able to hold on to those things. And it's really beautiful.
Yeah. So tell us, what are some traditional cooking methods that are most sacred in Black culinary heritage?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to start with your first kind of obvious one. So let's take greens, for example. Let's take collard greens, for example. So that method of taking something and stewing it down is going to cook for hours and really bring out either tenderness or a specific flavor profile. That's really very common. So if you have a tougher cut of meat, for example, if you're stewing and braising that for hours on end, That's really a hallmark and a trademark. You think about when folks were enslaved, you didn't have a lot of time to tend to your food. So you needed something that would basically cook low and slow for hours on end while you were doing other things. And then at the end of the day, you would come back and it made for something that was easier to eat, that was, that would taste better. That was something that was really important. I also kind of think about our traditions of seasoning, right? So I can't think of anything more bland or anything more insulting on a holiday table is a dish that does not have seasoning. I don't care if it's garlic powder, paprika, that does not matter to me. Is it seasoned? Otherwise, next year, someone's going to ask you to bring ice to the family gathering because it says you cannot
Oh boy, we don't want that.
No.
Can you describe the cultural significance of preparing meals collectively during the holidays and just gathering?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you say that, the first thing that comes to mind is my own grandmother, who made, I would say, 90% of the meals from scratch. There was very little that was store-bought. And so I distinctly remember, I'm sure many listeners can relate to this, being in her kitchen and watching her prepare food. And even though it wasn't necessarily, here, let me bestow this generational knowledge upon you, that was obviously not said, but it was absolutely implied that you would learn how to make chicken dumplings, that you would learn how to make collard greens, that you would learn how to make sweet potato pie. Those things were passed down. And I think that's something that's really special in our community because we absolutely are intergenerational. Again, you can trace this back to West Africa, where all the generations are intermingling to do the same thing and learning how to do the same thing, how to cook the same thing. That's something that really unites us. That's another piece of the puzzle. And I think it's really special, particularly because obviously, oral history is important in our community. And a lot of these recipes were not written down. It is a blessing if your grandmother or great grandmother or your aunt wrote these recipes down because so many of us don't have that. That's something that they knew how to cook by feel, by touch. It wasn't you opened the cookbook and there were these directions. It really comes from years of knowledge and experience in how to make something. And so I think that's another aspect of it. And I guess I would say if you guys have older family members who are still cooking, please write that down because we are literally losing recipes every single day. That's not just a phrase, that's real in our community. And in order for us to keep our heritage alive, which is so rich and so vibrant and so, seasoned, for lack of a better word, the only way to pass that down to our next generation is to continue that. And so you may not be cooking every single day. Maybe you are someone that cooks seasonally, but that generational knowledge that gets passed down is so, so important.
What are some things that feel most familiar with you or that you connect with when you're in the kitchen?
Oh my gosh. So we're going to get a little descriptive. So I hope folks are not hungry right now. So my grandmother, I was very fortunate that she cooked every single day. So when I came home from school, I didn't know what she was going to prepare, but I knew it was going to be amazing and delicious. The first thing that comes to mind is her collard greens. So now that I'm a grown up and think and kind of know how to prepare it, she literally was cooking this all day long. Must have been from the moment I left to when I got home at 3 o'clock. But an interesting thing that she did, she put white potatoes in her collard greens. And there's not a lot of people that do this, but think about it like this. So you've got the collard green, you've got a ham hock or some sort of pork or turkey, depending on how you're cooking it. But when you have that potato simmering in that pot liquor, and then you've got the greens and you've got the sweetness of it because it's cooked all day. But then you have the potatoes, so you have this starchy vegetable that has like basically absorbed all of that cooking for hours. Oh my gosh. So it really is an exceptional thing. I mean, on the one hand, it's probably a way to stretch a meal because you're adding something hearty, but it's ingenious because of the way it soaks up the pot liquor. It's incredible.
I'm hungry.
I was also going to say cornbread. And so that was one of the few things she actually bought from the store, Jiffy cornmeal, the little box.
Yep.
Yeah. So she would make that, but she would alter the recipe. And so by adding extra milk and butter, it really became more like a cake than a cornbread. And so by layering butter every 10 minutes in the oven on top of this, so by the time you get out, it's thick, it's sweet. You know, and it's just, oh my God, if you have it warm, it really is one of life's treasures.
It'll change your life.
100%.
Can you talk about some of the connection that we see from West Africa or the West Indies and maybe some familiar ingredients or dishes or cooking methods that we see and how that crosses over to the Americas?
Yeah, I mean, immediately, I think about yams and sweet potatoes. That's an ingredient. Yams would have been very prevalent in West Africa because of the temperature. It grows very easily there. So you can only find it in places that are really hot. And so in America, there were no yams. It just doesn't get hot enough here. Even in the South, people would think you would have it here, but you don't. But there were sweet potatoes. And so they were similar enough. And that's why you can go into a restaurant and that serves Southern food. You'll see yams on the menu. They're not yams. You're not getting yams. Do not believe the hype. They are lying to you. Those are sweet potatoes. But because of the prevalence of people who knew what it was, that's why hundreds of years later, we still call them yams, even if they're not. That practice of sugaring, when you think about candied yams, that's European. That becomes a whole different thing. But cooking them in ashes until they were tender, sometimes if you had some syrup, you would put a little bit over that to sweeten it up. That's something that's a direct connection to West Africa because that was one of the ways that it was being prepared there. You know, I would also say similarities, as I already said, kind of cooking low and slow for hours, stewing meats. That's definitely something that you would have seen in West Africa and you still see in a lot of our meals today. And honestly, I think I keep talking about seasoning just because it's so incredibly important that knowing how to use seasoning, how much seasoning to use, that's a skill. That's not something that's intuitive that you just know how to do. That's knowledge base. That is a craft and a skill. And so the people who were cooking these meals were incredibly intelligent. And so the way that you kind of think about macaroni and cheese, for example, you know, the way that that's cooked low and slow, you know, in a hearth or in an oven, those things again go back to West Africa, but that mac and cheese still needs to be seasoned. That still needs to have a taste to it other than the cheese, other than your pasta. So those are the things that we still practice today without even knowing it.
You've spoken about how gentrification displaces communities and erases food cultures. And, you know, during holiday gatherings, they're a moment for us to reconnect with those roots, especially during the holiday season when soul food often becomes commodified in pop culture and elevated in white-owned spaces. Soul food is often showcased in spaces outside of our community. How can we reclaim the narrative around our food ways and ensure that they're celebrated in all ways that honor our roots and reflect the depth of our culture?
Yeah, I think by not running away from it, right? So, you know, there's a very rich African American tradition of food in this country. And I think that, you know, there was a subset of people who, when they quote unquote left the farm and they moved to cities and they, you know, you get a little bit of money, it's that kind of soul food has, unfortunately, it's taken on a pejorative, you know, kind of form of thinking in some ways, because you're too good to eat that, or you're too rich to eat that. And oh, that's what enslaved people ate. Well, I mean, yes and no, right? So yes, no one's going to be like, you know, I don't, there are people who do go hard and pay for chitlins, for example, you know, but that does not mean that it's bad. Maybe you don't like it, that's fine. But I think embracing that this is our heritage and it's not something to be ashamed of. I mean, think about the rising cost of oxtail. Like, let's talk about that. Once it becomes flashy and in a media space, all of a sudden the price of oxtails is three times what it was when it was kind of in our community, right? Another example, pig feet. When you go to a higher end restaurant, they're called trotters. They will label them as trotters, but you're eating pig feet, which is something that we as a Black community really perfected and made something delicious when that was not the choice cut of meat, but you can still do things with it. So I think really kind of embracing all of it. So of course you have, your greatest hits of fried chicken, mac and cheese, that sort of thing. But there's so much more underneath that. For example, if you think about Anna Lewis's cookbook, when you actually look through it and you see that the things that are being made are seasonal and delicious and often not even meat heavy or grease heavy. There's that heritage too. And so I think that we all need to educate ourselves and really embrace all of our food. Our food is just as worthy to be on the international culinary table as French food, as Italian food, as any other group. Our food is just as worthy. But if we don't value our food, other folks won't either.
Well said. Deb Freeman, thank you so much for joining me in this conversation.
Thank you. It was a treat.
That was Deb Freeman. She's a food anthropologist and food editor at Style Weekly. Coming up next is Adrian Miller. He's a soul food historian and cultural preservation architect.
This idea that soul food's killing us and that people blame soul food entirely for the health outcomes that we see in the Black community.
Adrian Miller joins us to separate the fact from fiction about the complexity of the African American diet. Stay with us on Dialogue after this short break. From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Dialogue is an exchange about culture, straight from the soul. You can catch us on Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul. On today's dialogue, we're taking a look into our rich traditions and the connected tapestry of the Black diaspora of food during the holidays. Adrian E. Miller is a culinary historian, James Beard award-winning author, and the preeminent scholar illuminating the profound cultural narrative of soul food. His work transcends cookbook documentation, revealing how each recipe is a testament to Black resilience, innovation, and spiritual survival. As the author of Soul Food, The Surprising Story of an American Cuisine, Miller deconstructs myths and resurrects the dignity of a cuisine born from extraordinary human creativity. Adrian Miller, thank you so much for joining me.
So good to be with you, and what an intro. That was pretty impressive.
Thank you. Food connects us. Cooking is spiritual. How do the recipes passed down through generations carry the legacy, the whispers, the knowledge of those who came before us?
So for centuries, it was really what we would call an apprenticeship model. A lot of enslaved people were forced into those roles, and then their staff, as well as their successors, were forced into that role. So a lot of times it was just their being at the knee or by the side of somebody who was cooking and learning it that way. And then once we get past that, it's still many times an apprenticeship model. Sometimes you're voluntold, sometimes you volunteer. And then the blessing of this time is now we have all of these cookbooks. Black people are showing agency and putting together their recipes and disseminating them. We've got, for good and bad, social media videos and other things. But now, I mean, really, it's just really your fault if you don't want to learn how to cook. And I'm so grateful that we've got people that know what they're doing, who are sharing and telling people, showing people how to cook. Now, there is one lingering challenge. Is how to get that recipe out of the Black mama or the auntie who's just not giving it up. You might get most of the recipe, and then at a key moment, when they're showing you how to do something. It's like, hey, baby, can you just go over there and get whatever? And they distract you so they can put in the secret recipe. So we call those lesser peas, right? Like something key is left out. So you can't exactly make it the way they do. And it's so spiteful. But yeah, and we've got communal knowledge too, churches, family gatherings. There's so many ways now that this is passed on. And I'm so glad it is, because for a long time, our food was despised within and without our community. And so I'm glad that these things are being celebrated. And people are like, wait a minute. We make some delicious stuff that the world loves.
That part. I'm so happy that you brought up the stubborn aunties and grandmas who don't want to, oh, just use a pinch of this and a handful of this. That is relatable.
Yeah, I don't. So many of your listeners are gonna be like, "Yeah, I heard her say, I don't measure. I don't be using recipes." We've heard that a lot.
Yes, all my life growing up, for sure.
But the interesting thing about that is, and it's funny and it's fun and it leans into the creativity, but it also diminishes the skill that's involved in this. And I don't want us to ever lose that. I think one of the reasons why Black food traditions have been denigrated is because people have leaned into this Black people are natural cooks part, and it just doesn't really celebrate the craft element of it. And so I want to make sure we don't lose that.
Especially in a world that often attempts to flatten Black culinary traditions instead of giving us praise for the craft, how do you ensure the complexity and depth of soul food remaining uncompromised throughout your work?
Well, part of it is just telling the story, and then also deeply researching what I'm going to share before I share it, because there's so deeply ingrained perceptions of what soul food is, what it was, what it will be. And so a lot of my work has been challenging that, even with African Americans, because I'll say something and I'll say, hey, that thing you believe about soul food actually really isn't true. And people will not let it go, like chitlins. There's this belief, that's the most controversial part of soul food, right? There's nobody on the fence about chitlins. Chitterlings, for those who don't know, which are the intestines of an animal. They generally, it's a general term for animal intestines, but we think of it for pig intestines. There's nobody on the fence. They either love them or they hate them. And but there's this notion that chitlins were wholly created for Black people. It was part of the tradition, like we had to get the worst parts of the pig and all this kind of stuff. So I tell people, white people have been eating chitlins for centuries. In fact, every year in Sally, South Carolina, there is a chitlin festival started and run by white people. This whole idea that, Black people got the worst stuff, it doesn't hold up to historical scrutiny. And so that's been a lot of the challenge. And then the other thing I'll just share is this idea that soul food's killing us, and that people blame soul food entirely for the health outcomes that we see in the Black community. And when you take a closer look at what people are eating, it's not usually a ton of soul food. They're eating a lot of other stuff, fast food, convenience food, all this other stuff. And so I'm just trying to challenge people to just have more scrutiny and understand the complexity of the African American diet, and then real just have some critical thinking, because what are nutritionists telling us to eat? More dark leafy greens, more sweet potatoes, more fish, okra, hibiscus. These are superfoods now, and these are part of the soul food wheelhouse. So does it compute that the stuff that nutritionists are telling us to eat, that have been a cornerstone of our diets, are the same things that are killing us? Does that really make sense? This idea that soul food is killing us really is misunderstanding what soul food is, because it's really the celebration food of the American South. A lot of dishes like the pies, the glorious, cakes and all that kind of stuff, the fried chicken, the barbecue. That's celebration food that was meant to be eaten every once in a while. It was not supposed to be a daily thing. And you take any culture's celebration food and eat it on the regular, it's not going to be good for your body. I don't care what cuisine it is. So if we understand certain aspects of soul food, that there's the day in and day out that's very vegetable forward, has roots in Africa, very good for us, and you've got the celebration stuff, it's all about balance.
Your scholarship goes beyond academic research, it's an act of cultural preservation. How do you see your work as a culinary historian as a form of resistance and remembrance?
The main thing was to show love for our food traditions. And that's the greatest act of resistance of all, because there's been so much haterade thrown at Black food traditions. And so I just wanted to challenge that narrative with information, and pun intended, to bring the receipts to talk about these things. And then the other thing is, I have to be critical of my own work and just say, I'm just an appetizer. Well, you know, so please follow my footsteps. You may find sources that I did not. There may, you know, because one of the cool things about the information age is that more things are getting digitized, sources that were not readily available. So you don't have to pay money to travel to all these obscure libraries around the world and find these things. You can just get on the internet and maybe find them. So I'm fully aware that somebody may come after one and say, hey, Adrian was on the right track, but he was not right about this, and this is why. And I believe in progress. I believe that we should find truth. So the more that people can take the sources that are available and then critically assess them, just don't take everything as a given, and delve deeper and show that love, I think would be a great thing. Because the unfortunate thing about our current era is there's just a lot of people making stuff up. And it is easy to make up stuff right now, because food history has not been well documented. So you have to be even creative to develop a food history. You have to look at a lot of different things. And so there's a lot of people that are just trusting someone to curate the past and present a viable vision of what food is and the food history and where it's going. That's what I hope that will happen in this age of misinformation and disinformation, because some people are just making stuff up in bad ways to harm kind of the perception of these food traditions. So there's a lot going on in this cultural stew that we have happening right now. But if people are willing to be curious, to apply some rigor to the information they get, I think we all get closer to the truth. And I just don't think that's a bad thing.
How do soul food recipes encode stories of survival and strength that mainstream culinary narratives frequently don't highlight or just try to erase?
Yeah, so, a lot of the mainstream narratives have been Eurocentric. And so from their perspective, they're seeing things happen, but there's no accounting for, okay, you know, these Black people didn't show up as cultural blank slates, especially when it comes to their food. So they brought something with them from West Africa. Now, one of the challenges we have historically is that we're talking about many societies that have oral history traditions. And so this stuff wasn't written down. And to the extent that things are written down, sometimes it's through a European narrator. So we don't know how much we can trust that. But given all of that, what we find is that once you delve into that history and you can find trustworthy sources and start to chart how the food progresses over time, you can see these enslaved Africans showing up in a new place that's not familiar, but trying to recreate home with stuff that looked familiar or things that they found substitutes for that would remind them of something back home. So for instance, greens, right? The greens is a central part of the West African diet, but we're talking about tropical greens. So when you come to a temperate climate place or a subtropical place, you're probably not going to be able to grow those greens. But there are these other greens from Europe that have a similar flavor profile, the bitter greens of Europe. So that's why we're eating collards, kale, mustard, turnips, cabbage, because they were similar in profile, not exact, but similar to bitter leaf and these other greens. So you can see this adaptation, you can see the creativity, you can see the means of survival, because enslaved people had their food controlled. It was a display of power from the enslaver to say, okay, once a week, I'm just gonna give you X amount of food and you gotta figure out how to survive outside of this couple of pounds of meat and 5 pounds of some starch, cornmeal, rice, sweet potatoes, whatever I'm giving you, and a jug of molasses. You gotta figure out how to survive. So we find that our enslaved ancestors foraged, gardened, fished, and hunted to round out that diet. And so it's a remarkable testament to the will to survive, even in some of the most horrible circumstances in human history.
What are some other dishes that represent the most powerful narrative of transformation and hope?
I think about, the Savannah red rice, this idea that there wasn't rice native to West Africa. Probably like Senegal, Gambia, Sierra Leone, that area was a rice growing region. And so they had a rice that had a reddish hue. And so there were attempts to grow that rice in the Americas, but it just didn't thrive as well as the Asian rice. So, these cooks had cultural memory. So they just took some of these dishes and they said, okay, we're just going to take this white rice, we're going to add some tomato and make it red. And so it's going to look like something we used to have. Right, so that's an I think a beautiful example of adaptation. I love red drink. Anybody who knows my work knows that I'm a big cheerleader for red drink. And in soul food culture, red is a color and a flavor. Black people, we don't get caught up in calling things cherry or strawberry, or that it has hints of cranberry. It's just red. But red drink is a nod to the hibiscus drinks of West Africa. Bissap, Sobolo. And other things that come across the Atlantic. If you're familiar with Caribbean cuisine, especially Jamaica, sorrel. And then it makes its way to Latin America, where it's called Flor de Jamaica or Agua de Jamaica, Jamaica flower or Jamaica water. And this is all a riff off a West African drink. And so it shows the adaptation, and then also just the dissemination of the culture and how other cultures readily adopted these things. And then not everybody agrees with me, but I think red Kool-Aid is a nod to all of these things. So I see a cultural connection there that I think is just quite beautiful.
As a Trinidadian, I love me some sorrel.
Nice.
Love sorrel.
Yeah. This is awesome. It's a great drink.
It is.
You just see how these things travel with people as they get to a new place. And it's all an effort to recreate home, even though they're adapting to new circumstances.
What practices are you seeing right now that ensure that these culinary traditions remain living, breathing cultural expressions?
One of the things that I think is really cool that's happening right now is you're seeing more chefs do what I call diasporic dinners. So what they do is they're doing more storytelling with their food. So the first course will be based somewhere in West Africa. And it may be their own personal story. Maybe they've done the genealogical research to figure out where their people are from, things like that. The DNA test, whatever. So the first dish will be West Africa, and then the next dish will be someplace in the Caribbean, to show that journey. And then the next course will be someplace in the American South. And then typically where their family is from, most people were in the American South, but some it could be in the North, wherever they were from in the United States. And then depending on other courses, they may just reinforce that storytelling. So I think that's really cool, because they're connecting the dots in ways that probably their diners have never really thought about. And chefs are coming out and before the course is consumed, they're coming out and explaining what it is and just making those connections clearer. I think another thing that's really cool, which I mentioned earlier, is that we're just getting more Black people who are writing their recipes down and sharing them. More publishers are actually publishing Black cookbooks. I remember when I first was pitching my soul food book, publishers, when no commercial publisher was interested, only the University of North Carolina Press was interested. I'm glad they gave me the opportunity. But they were saying things, even though I was writing a history of soul food, I was hearing things like, well, there's already a soul food cookbook in the market. And that cookbook was out 10 years ago, right? But then, so there's no more room in the market for anything about soul food other than that book that's 10 years old. And though every year, how many books on French food, Italian food, Chinese food, you name the culture. There's always plenty of room on the bookshelf for their food. So I'm glad that publishers are being more expansive in what they're publishing. But there's a lot of people saying, if these publishers aren't interested, I'm just going to do my blog. I'm just going to do my videos and whatever. So we're just getting a lot more information to the street. So I think that's what's really important, that we're having more storytelling from the people who are steeped in these traditions. And I think that makes a huge difference rather than other people telling our story. Now, let me just say this, even though I just said that, I believe that anybody can make any culture's food, but you've got to be authentic to that culture. You've got to hit the flavor profile. because nobody wants a nasty version of somebody's cultural food. You've got to acknowledge where you learn this, give a shout out to those sources, and show love. So one thing I've been arguing is I think there needs to be more cultural sourcing in restaurants. So, right now you go to a restaurant, they're going to tell you the farm where that animal was raised or that plant was grown, that vegetable was grown. You're going to learn the personal habits of the animal that you're about to eat. So why can't we just pause and say, hey, this dish is from this culture, traces its roots to this part of West Africa, or it was created by this black chef, or it was created in this black run restaurant. I mean, it would be transformative if every time Nashville Hot, whatever was served, somebody would say, this was created by the people who run Prince's Hot Chicken in Nashville.
How do you hope your scholarship continues to a larger understanding of Black culinary heritage? And what do you think, as you witness the evolution of soul food, what are you feeling about the hope for it in the future?
Well, there was a time, actually, when I started the book, because there was so much haterade thrown at soul food, I thought, is it going to die out? I knew that it would exist at some, with some, to some extent in the American South, because there's just far too much cultural momentum as a regional food. But I just wondered, can it, will it exist outside the South? And I think the kind of the popularity of Southern food over the last couple of decades has definitely kept soul food interest higher. But I think one of the things that's really exciting right now is just the advent of vegetable forward soul food. So vegetarian and vegan. I think a lot of the exciting things that are happening in the soul food space right now are in those parts of the cuisine, those genres. A lot of creativity, a lot of delicious food. And it also is cool that these chefs are reconnecting to West Africa. And I think there's an intentionality there where people are trying to rediscover West African ingredients and bring them to the forefront. There's a grain called fonio, which is an ancient West African grain, which is now people are like, oh, it's drought resistant. It's very nutritious. Maybe we need to make this grain more prominent. So, looking to West Africa to deal with the hunger needs of the world today. So, though I think all of those things are really exciting. And then again, it just I hope that my work is an appetizer, that it actually stimulates people, more people, to delve into their own food history. If you got an elder there and in your family who's in their 80s and 90s and they're still sharp and they still like to tell stories, just maybe you ought to turn on that video recorder app, put it in front of them, and just let them talk, ask them questions, go in the kitchen if they'll let you, stand next to them, be that sous chef, learn as much as you can, even though they're going to try to distract you. You maybe even let them, maybe they'll let you turn on a video. We have a moment now where there's still a lot of knowledge out there that's not lost. And it's really, this is the challenge of every generation, right? It's up to us to capture the stories and then to share them again, to pass them along. And it's up to us to decide whether we want to do that or not.
Adrian Miller, thank you so much for coming here today and dropping all your knowledge and wisdom.
Yep, I try to drop knowledge like hot biscuits, so I hope I did that during our time together.
Definitely. Thank
All
you.
right, peace.
Peace. You can find the Dialogue Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and YouTube. And you can give us a follow on Instagram and Facebook at Illinois Soul. This episode of Dialogue was produced by Zainab Qureshi, Troy McDonald, and myself, Kennedy Vincent. Our news and public affairs director is Reginald Hardwick, and production assistance by Steve Mork. Dialogue is a part of Illinois Soul and Illinois Public Media. Join us for our next dialogue every Saturday morning at 11 a.m. and Tuesday night at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul FM 101.1 and WILL AM 580 Wednesdays at 8 p.m.